You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is James Kelman, author of How Late It Was, How Late, published in America by Norton. It's the winner of the 1994 Booker Prize. And I wanted to begin by asking you, is this book, your work, considered radical work in Scottish, modern Scottish literature?
It is now, Moore. It's taken a bit of time, I think, for people to work out what was actually happening. You know, that work by, say, likes of myself or the poet Tom Leonard. And it's been difficult for people to see a context in it. It's taken a while, really. I think it also took people a while to see that there might have been something of formal interest in it. And that actually pertains to what occurred after the Booker Prize Award. Some of the elitism and incredible bias against my work is similar to what happened earlier on when I was writing. Now, because you write of a subject matter that they can, some people in society would consider to be of the lower orders, they think therefore that it's impossible for anything written about them or about the lower or within the lower orders to have literary merit. Now, even in this novel, I would still be asked by people if whether I revise. Now, I was asked that after a disaffection won literary award in 5 years ago. And one of the judges in there who awards the prize had taken myself and my wife for a meal, you know, and he said, do you ever revise? Now, that kind of thing, to me, just sets you back. It's like if you're black and you're a dancer and you've spent your life perfecting this, someone comes up and, you know, and says, God, you've got some talent, you know, this natural thing that's come to you, as though somehow you've never worked at it, you know. And that is what's often still said by critics, you know. In other words, it's so, that line between elitism and racism, you know.
Well, it's very interesting to me because my sense of your career is that you began with a huge number of stories and fragments in order to acquire a facility with voices and rhythms and modes of expression that sort of click on and off like lights, you know, consciousnesses embarking and then disappearing very rapidly, almost as if to be able to establish within a matter of a few lines a life within a voice. Yeah. And then questions of larger units seem to have followed, and how to build a novel seems very much to be the process that you were embarked upon from early in your career.
Yeah, I see. I still regard myself as a short story writer, although I've now published four novels. But again, the techniques are the formal things that I don't see why a novel shouldn't be like a short story. When we say these things, we're really kind of implying that the short story is a tight and more precise art form, and in the novel you have room, for example, to have these quiet periods or something. But usually that, in a way, what I've found dubious about that is that some novelists or those who really enjoy the novel are content to have lazy periods, really, in a sense where imprecise and indirect prose can be used, like the form that a journalist would use to describe something, you know, so it becomes possible to say, he was angry for that year. You know, like, what the hell's going on here? Now, that's not allowed by, generally, in the short story form. Having said that, you know, I mean, Then you come upon Tolstoy, and he kind of breaks every rule in the book with his short stories.
He was angry for those
singer,
50
or
years.
Bashir, a singer who also comes out and does these things. How the hell? Okay. The rules have kind of expanded.
Now, I first encountered your work when I was sent Greyhounds for Breakfast by Farrah Straus, and they later sent me A Disaffection. And it seems as if this is the second or perhaps even third wave of your American career. There hasn't been an immediate embrace. It was as if Farrah Straus, normally very loyal to the writers it published, didn't find a way to speak to America about your work. And paradoxically, it seems, although this novel, How Late It Was, How Late, narrated by a small-time thief in Glasgow, it would seem as if certainly the hero of the book would find the Booker Prize an anomaly, and yet it's the Booker Prize that is prying open the door for you here. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't really feel much about it. I've got to say, I don't. In a way, I don't care. As soon as you embark on writing prose, or especially the novel, as a young writer or an old writer, you have to be prepared for certain things, and that is the reality of the situation of publishing, you know. It doesn't suit me to be publishing hardback, for instance, but I have to accept it. This is the way it operates, so I accept it, you know. I'd much prefer to be publishing softback, paperback, so that people who don't have a lot of dough can go and buy the book, you know, without having to borrow or whatever. So for me, literary prizes are nothing to do with the writer. They're to do with the publishing industry and the retail book-selling industry, and all I can do is allow them to get on with it, but not to allow it to interfere too much with my life, in the sense that you cannot allow it to put you off the work in any way, you know.
Now, I'm very interested, you know, because from America, from this point of view, I have no way of knowing what the Scottish writing scene is like. I've read Alistair Gray, whose work is immensely appealing to me, hilarious and unpredictable. Do you appeal to the same audience?
I'm not sure. You know, are you talking about within Scotland?
Yes.
I mean, Alistair and I are very close friends,
yes,
and very fond of each other's writing, but I mean, again, there's a diversity in Scottish culture and the literary tradition that means that you can begin from similar and related premises about what good literature, or what, not even good literature, but what writers can be writing about in terms of what's happened in the world of literature for the last couple of hundred years, you know, and you come out writing something completely different from each other. That's bloody healthy. That's the way it should be. So the thing is, though, that, you see, there is a kind of distinct Scottish literary tradition, as there is a Scottish philosophical tradition that's very obscured, you know. And there were writers doing very good work in English and paying attention to some of the things that I'm paying attention right just now. Like 200 years ago, you had James Hogg writing Confessions. Now, the thing again is that Hogg is doing things technically there that there's very few that were capable of doing for a long time afterwards. You know, and I would include Gogol and people, right? He's writing, Hogg's writing about the same time or just slightly before. Now, but interestingly enough, Hogg treated Goethe, right? You know, now, so some of the technical difficulties or experimentalism that Goethe was doing in prose, as he does in, say, Young Werther, was also being done by some Scottish writers. So what happened there, for example, was the Blackwood's Magazine, which was a very powerful and popular and probably the most famous English language magazine in the world, next to the Edinburgh Review, about 150 or more years ago. Now, some of the things to do with voice and consciousness around that, the pulse, etc., etc., that gave rise to some of the most tremendous genre stories. And a very old technical problem for writers was, how can I write a story about a man who is dead? How can I write a story in the first party about a character who dies? You know, in other words, how can this be committed to page? You know,
I'm so grateful that you've brought this up, because when I was in school, I spent a semester reading so-called Gothic literature.
Yeah.
Aside from William Beckford, whose Gothic I loved because of its prose, for me it was, you know, a vast cesspool of really unreadable work until I came upon James Hogg's Confessions of a Justified Sinner. And then you want to say, would you please stop grouping works because they were written historically near yeah. one another or because they share a genre.
Yeah.
Can't we have works grouped by the quality of the imagination? And Hogg, for instance, seems to be, in that book at least, one of the great inventors of world literature.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it's the point you're making about the Gothic or that inability to see beyond a genre or whatever. Now, the Blackwood, that kind of real technical problem that Goethe faced up to, so did Hogg, you know, and so have a few other writers, and are seen it as a problem. It no longer has to be a problem nowadays, right? Not since Kafka, in my estimation, right? As opposed to Joyce, Kafka makes that, for me, that breakthrough. That. But anyway, now, seeing that some of the Gothic stuff in Blackwood, what you have is, there's a story by one of the original Noctes Ambrosianae's writers, a great Irish writer who's almost unknown for the last 100 years. Now, he begins a story by saying, "When I was hanged last week." Now, that's the way the short story begins. Now, of course, that's precisely the story and that range of writing that would have great such an influence on a young Poe, because Edgar Allan Poe was an avid Blackwoods man. He spent time in Scotland when he was 12, and what you have is, like, this kind of circular thing where, you know, through the surrealists, even into Japanese writing and all, through
mm-hmm.
these,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Now, that brings up the question of the supernatural, and this is a very good time to raise it. Because although you are described, I think, by imperceptive critics, because they describe a lower depths realist, I would think of the Gorky school. Mm. But as I read How Late It Was, How Late, I thought of other things entirely, that somehow or other these qualities were being put at the service of a large and mysterious world, as if life were somehow a big box in which this small-time robber narrator had been shaken.
Yeah.
And so finding everything is new to him. Finding that he's blind is a discovery.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me to be a much more radical approach
yeah.
than the, you know, life of the lower class that was being described.
That's one of those kind of, again, one of these elitist assumptions that working class culture can only be gritty, or it can only be to do with realism, and it is not possible, for example, for somebody who is unemployed or whatever, or on welfare, for the third generation to like opera. You know, these kind of things are almost a logical contradiction, you know.
Now, do you think, though, that is part of English Empire thinking? Because Kafka, for instance, can certainly, in the animal world, write about the mouse, Josephine the Mouse Singer, or the mole, the creatures underground, law clerks, and people who spend their lives simply copying. And there is in American literature a whole staff of Bartleby the Scrivener types whose lives are extremely minimal, very dour, very bare. Is it upper class, lower class empire writing? Is that the...
I tend to see things also in terms of what formal breakthroughs have occurred. This might sound really kind of ridiculous in some ways, Michael. What I would say was, it's taken a long, long number of years to capture the narrative, the third-party narrative, right? It's taken a long number of years amongst writers, you know? And before you can get that richness of a real multifaceted human being, you need to have the third-party narrative. I'm talking about in prose, right?
Uh-huh.
And for maybe 180 years or so, the only way out was through the eye voice. Well, not as much as that. 180 years ago, rather. The way out was through the eye voice. Kind of romantic. In the romantic tradition, usually we are left there with fighting the authority of your father or something like that. It was a similar kind of... But the real battle or the war was to take over that third-party narrative. And that's what, to me, Kafka's achievement was, as opposed to some other contemporaries of that period. Now, what's happened, and as being part of that struggle, is the development of these other traditions. That has allowed in the decolonisation, right, of working side by side with a decolonisation process within narrative prose. that I, for example, can now go, right, from now on I've got a third party, that this is a third party, and this, I can actually write right now, this man walked down the street, right, and this is not dialogue, you know, whereas prior to this, the existence of ordinary working class people or marginalised groups such as blacks, such as Jews, such as anybody you like, these marginalised groups would be kept in dialogue. They would be kind of observed empirically, you know, but they would not have that the fullness of that.
This is very interesting. I'm speaking to James Kelman, the author of How Late It Was, How Late. So in other words, if I take you correctly, this novel, which is narrated in part in a first person and in a third person voice, is allowing its underworld narrator both to have his own subjectivity, but also to live in a third person world that is his.
Yeah. Yes, that is it. And that to me has been one of the root things of the great individual cultural traditions. Now, I mean, I was asked earlier about, say, Rabbi Julia Neuberger, who was one of the most outspoken critics of the Booker Award. And for me, the peculiar thing and the ironic thing there also was how that's been, the tradition that I'm talking about has been so central in terms of, Yiddish literature. You know, these same problems that early writers in Yiddish had to face, say, Mendele Sephorim, who had to make the decision about, no, I shall write in Yiddish and not Hebrew. And Isaac Bashevis, singer, obvious example, but... And also in other traditions too, I mean, within the old Yugoslavia, you know, these kind of battles that writers have basically this kind of business about the indigenous and the need for our own language, you know, the need to be able, the freedom to work from within our own language and the repercussions that have, they're always bound in with the formal, they can't be separated really. You know?
Now tell me, when you were young, you appreciated Jack Kerouac, yes?
Yeah, in the same, yeah.
Do you feel that in your reading of American literature that he was writing an American demotic?
I don't know because I've not read him since I was about 17, so I don't really know much. I don't really know. In retrospect, I see it as to do with voice and to do with the indigenous. I see it to do with almost, the politics is almost overt. I mean, for me, the worst of that sort of writing has always been that, you know, I hesitate to show, it's not contempt, but, and they had, there was that unwillingness from that, the generation writers I know, like that, the Black Mountain School, to actually just come right up front and be political. I just found that, I don't even want it, I'm probably wrong in saying it, but it's always just irritated and annoyed me about it, that they weren't brave.
Well, it's very interesting because in America, you see, for many, many years, there's been the assumption that political writing is by necessity, because partisan, unsophisticated. As a result, many of our most political writers nevertheless insist that they are not political. Yeah. Something that one can't imagine taking place in European literature.
I feel that that's just, it's like they've accepted the disinformation or they're happy to accept the disinformation. Either they're naive or as Joseph K might say, or they're telling lies. I don't accept that at all. I feel that that is just like, it's propaganda. I mean, the idea that in 1995 that we could try and make a distinction between art and politics, I just find that absurd. If we gave them the benefit of the doubt, then they're probably thinking in terms of like the way that the Stalinists would about like what, like social realism. You know, you cannot be a writer for any liberation struggle unless you reflect the labour movement or the guys working in factories. That is also junk, but it has also bedeviled people in other parts of the world, both in my country and in, say, a good example might be South Africa. You know, where in opposition to a country like Nigeria, Nigeria is a very, strikes me as a really sophisticated way of the arguments about language they have there. They have about five different arguments, all beginning from a position of, yes, let's accept that, you know, the basic premise is accepted. South Africa, probably through then, Politics differ, you know, but prose writing has been kind of, it's been difficult for the prose writers to get out of that socialist realism, naturalistic approach.
Well, part of it, I think, is that your work, for instance, strikes me as being very funny. And how late it was, how late, by the time the hero, blind, is enmeshed in the bureaucracies of a hospital, helping another blind man to negotiate an elevator, and neither of them at first realize that the other is blind, and each of them trying to find a way to use the stick to keep the elevator door open. Well, some of Beckett's silent comedy going on here. Yeah. But people have a way of assuming that if you are talking about the political, you're talking about the idealistic. Certainly humor isn't expected. And if you're talking about the underworld, you must be talking about the deserving and the noble.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, like, it's just an unwillingness to accept 100% humanness. You know, it's just this inability to begin from the idea that the wholeness of human beings, you know, yes, even someone who's deaf, dumb and blind and has committed heinous crimes is a child abuser who's the worst sort of racist you could ever meet, that even they're actually whole human beings. I mean, that's the reality, whether we like it or not. You know?
Now, where does experimentalism, formal experimentalism, enter?
Well, experimentalism... Well, I used to like playing about a lot as a young writer. But that usually trying to, so I would do short stories in voices, you know, like the voice of this, basically almost pastiche, close to pastiche, if not pastiche. But again, I think the formal of the technical thing is, it's always a function of the story. I think, as I mentioned earlier, that formal thing, like, especially in a novel, I find anyway, I wouldn't generalise from it, but working in a novel, ultimately there is some formal problem that you've got to resolve, you know. There is something that's going to have to be resolved, and then it ultimately will be formal.
Well, for instance here, the problem of narrating a novel in a first-person voice by a person who is now blind.
Yeah.
Yes, is that the formal difficulty being examined, the phenomenology of consciousness that can't describe itself fully?
Not necessarily. That would, you know, that would be, that is also there, yeah. But the thing that would give rise to that are that I would say, no, I had worked that out formally three novels ago, a novel called The Busking Dr. Hind, where it was such a problem for me there that I was never quite sure whether I was showing the working, you know, all the nuts and bolts in it, you know. But to try and work through the transition from third party, you know, I always knew it was a possibility. Right, so I can actually be as mechanical as to talk about how it is not possible to do it. And the way it is not possible is if you distinguish between dialogue and narrative. In other words, Joyce would not be able to do it until he left off. That's why this stupid old anachronistic term, the stream of consciousness. But the only way into it is not distinguishing between dialogue and narrative, you know, whether quotation marks or whether a dash or whatever. You have to find a way of being able to, or find a precision that allows you, you know, just the flow of someone speaking and then into narrative without a distinction. If you don't do that, you won't perform these transitions, these technical transitions. It's not a possibility.
I want to ask you about, I don't know the best way to put it, but the mind-body division here. There seems to be very much a way of dividing the mental world from the physical world, or uniting them. I'm not sure which, but could you speak a bit about that?
Yeah, there is a what I could say is that there's this kind of thing amuses me in a way when I see it operating really well. No, it doesn't amuse me. It takes my breath away as a writer. Now, Kafka does it in The Castle. Towards the end of the novel, The Castle, poor old Kay, the land surveyor now, he's at the point where he almost gets entry to the castle. And what happens is that his last hurdle in a way is a very friendly guy who comes to meet him in the inn And the problem is that Kay, the land surveyor, is very tired, and he's trying not to fall asleep. And while he's trying not to fall asleep, the character is in there saying to him, "Well, I'm about to offer you the key into the castle. You thought it was hard. It's not that hard." And he's a very boring guy. And not only is he very boring, but Kay is very tired, you know. So, in fact, Kay doesn't hear him when he tells him precisely. And the guy is saying, "But you're so tired and inattentive right now that you won't even know that I'm telling you this." So Kafka performs that illusion, you know, so well. And it is a kind of it's a good example in a way of that, the reality of the existential in art, how you get that the opposite of description, or the opposite. It's just this, the pure reality of the thing and physicality of the thing as it happens, the great illusion.
The being.
The great illusion, the being, precisely.
That seems to be very much the central concern of this book. What is being? What is, when you take away, you know, someone's sight, what is his nature? How does, what is the being of an individual within a culture that wants to box him within an identity that's going to forever limit him? What is the irreducible thing? Am I right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the irreducible thing in him is the absolute resilience. You know, a difficulty again for me in the writing was it would always burden the sentimental, and that was what I always had to watch out for, because ultimately I do regard the character as heroic.
You know? That his way of battering on, as he says.
Yeah, because it really is resilient. He's a to my mind, knowing the workings, you know, I've spent time involved in industrial disease and trying to work on behalf of victims, you know. Now, so I know, the horror of the situation of trying to convince the state or a doctor that you have a terminal illness, when you know that they know you have it, and you know that you're actually being murdered slowly by some asbestos company, and they won't acknowledge it. And neither will the state, neither will your own doctor, because of the implications in civil law, right, and compensation, etc. So, to my mind, this character, Sammy, handles it very well. He handles the situation very well. He knows he has to conserve energy, and that is so important. You know, for anyone out in the street, getting through a night without a bed, etc., it's conserving energy, conserving your strength, you know. These things are very important. They're absolutely crucial to survival.
So the narrative method is a narratology of energy conservation. I've been speaking to James Kelman, the author of How Late It Was, How Late, published in America by W.W. Norton. It's the winner of the 1994 Booker Prize. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
We're bold in books. Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.